Zuger strode angrily through the camp in the rising heat and bright sunlight of morning. His face and arms were blackened with soot, his eyes still red and smarting from the smoke of the fires. His beard was scorched and his eyelashes burned half away from fighting the flames. They had lost most of their stores and equipment, for the fire had run away through the tents and thatched shelters. Zuger paused to glance at the charred and trodden scraps of canvas that were all that were left of the tents. They would miss them when the rains broke, but that was the very least of their losses. He tried to make a mental list of the most grievous damage they had suffered. There were firstly only 46 porters left out of more than 100. Of course, he could expect Jan Schroot and his Hottentots to bring in a few more. They were at this moment scouring the valleys and hills around the camp for scattered survivors. He could still hear the Kuduhorn trumpets calling in the stragglers. However, many would have risked the long and dangerous journey back to Tet rather than a recurrence of the night's attack. And they would have seized the opportunity to desert. Others would be lost after their midnight flight and panic. They would fall prey to wild animals or succumb to thirst. Half a dozen had been killed by random musketry fire and by the retreating brigands who had deliberately fired into the masses of unarmed porters. Four others were so badly wounded that they would die before nightfall. That was the most serious loss, for without porters they were helpless. Without porters to carry them, what remained of the carefully selected equipment and trade goods were as useless to them as if they had left them in London or dumped them overboard from Huron's deck. Of the equipment itself, it would take them hours to count their losses, to find out what had burned and what they could salvage from their stinking, smouldering mass of cloth and canvas, what they could pick out of the trodden and dusty mess scattered down the rock hillside. The scene reminded Zuger forcefully of so many other battlefields. The terrible destruction and waste affronted him, as it had done before. The few remaining porters were already at work, picking over the field like a line of harvesters, retrieving anything of value from the ash and the dust. Little Juba was with them, concentrating on the search for Robin's medical stores and books and instruments. Robin herself had set up an emergency clinic under the wide green branches of the mukuzi tree in the centre of the camp, and when Zuger paused to look at the wounded men who still awaited her attention, and at the dead bodies laid out in a neat row and covered with a blanket or a scrap of charred and dirty canvas, he was angry with himself all over again. Though what alternative had there been for him, he wondered. If he had turned the camp into an armed fortress, it would have meant enduring a long, drawn-out siege with Comancho's wolves skulking around the perimeter, sniping and harrying them until their opportunity came. No, he had been right to set the trap and end it at a single stroke. At least now he could be certain that the Portuguese was still in full flight for the coast. But the price had been too high, and Zuger was still angry. The expedition, so well conceived and lavishly equipped, had ended in disaster before it had achieved a single one of its objectives. The loss of equipment and life had been heavy, but that was not what burned so acidly in Zuger's stomach as he paused at the perimeter of the devastated camp and lifted his eyes longingly towards the high broken ground of the southern escarpment. It was the idea of having to give up before he had begun, and when he was so close, so very close. 20, 50, not more than 100 miles ahead of him lay the frontier of the Empire of Monomotapa. Behind him, 100 miles to the north, was the dirty little village of Tet, and the wide river which was the beginning of the long, ignoble road back to England, back to obscurity, back to a commission in a third-rate regiment, back to conformity and the wearying discipline of the cantonments of the Indian Army. Only now that he was doomed to return to that life did he realize how deeply he had hated and resented it, just how much the desire to escape it had brought him here to this wild, untouched land. Like a long-term prisoner who has tasted one day of sweet freedom, so the prospect of return to his cage was that much more painful now. The pain of it cramped his chest, and he had to breathe deeply to control it. He turned away from the southern vista of ragged peaks and savage black rock cliffs, and he walked slowly to where his sister worked quietly in the shade of the mukuzi. She was pale, with dark smudges of fatigue and strain under her green eyes. Her blouse was speckled with spots of her patient's blood, and her forehead appeared blistered with tiny beads of perspiration. She had started work in the darkness, by the light of a bull's-eye lantern, and now it was mid-morning. She looked up wearily as Zuga stood over her. "We won't be able to go on," he said quietly. She stared at him a moment, without change of expression, and then dropped her eyes and went on smearing salve on the badly burned leg of one of the porters. She had treated the worst cases first, and was now finishing with the burns and abrasions. "We've lost too much vital equipment," Zuga explained. "Stores that we need to survive." Robin did not look up this time. "And we've not enough porters to carry what is left." Robin began bandaging the leg with her full attention. "Papa made the transverser with four porters," she observed mildly. "Papa was a man," Zuga pointed out reasonably, and Robin's hands stilled ominously, and her eyes narrowed. But Zuga had not noticed. "A woman cannot travel or survive without the necessities of civilization," he went on seriously. "That is why I'm sending you back to Tet. I'm sending Sergeant Cheroot and five of his Hottentots to escort you. You'll have no difficulty once you reach Tet. I will send with you what remains in cash, £100 for the launch downriver to Quelimane, and a passage to Cape Town on a trader. There you can draw the money I deposited in Cape Town to pay for a passage on the mail ship." She looked up at him. "And you?" she asked. Until then, he had not made the decision. "The important thing is what happens to you," he told her gravely. And then he knew what he was going to do. "You will have to go back, and I am going on alone." "It'll take more than Yun Cheroot and five of his damned Hottentots to carry me," she told him. And the oath was a measure of her determination. "Oh, be reasonable, sissy." "Why should I start now?" she asked sweetly. Zuga opened his mouth to reply angrily, then closed it slowly and stared at her. There was a hard, uncompromising line to her lips, and the prominent, almost masculine jaw was clenched stubbornly. "I don't want to argue," he said. "Good," she nodded. "That way you won't waste any more of your precious time." "Do you know what you're letting yourself in for?" he asked quietly. "As well as you do," she replied. "We won't have any trade goods to buy our way through the tribes." She nodded. "That means we will have to fight our way through if anyone tries to stop us." He saw the shadow in her eyes at that, but there was no wavering of her determination. No tents for shelter, no canned food, no sugar or tea. He knew what that meant to her. "We will live straight off the land, and what we can't scavenge or kill or carry, we go without. We'll have nothing but powder and shot." "You'd be a fool to leave the quinine," she told him quietly, and he hesitated. "The bare minimum of medicines," he agreed. "And remember, it won't be just a week or a month." "We'll probably go a great deal faster than we have so far," she answered quietly, as she stood up and brushed off the seat of her breeches. The choice of what to take and what to leave had been nicely balanced, Zuga thought, as he listed and weighed the new loads. He had chosen paper and writing equipment in place of sugar and most of the tea, his navigational instruments in place of spare boots, for the boots they wore could be resold with raw buffalo hide. Quinine and other medicines, together with Robin's instruments in place of the extra clothing and blankets, powder and shot in place of trade beads and cloth. The pile of abandoned equipment grew steadily. Cases of potted jams, bags of sugar, canned foods, insect nets, folding camp chairs and cots, cooking pots, Robin's enamelled hip bath and her flowered chamber pot, trade goods, Makani cloth and beads, hand mirrors and cheap knives. When the pile was complete, Zuga put fire into it, a token of finality and of determination. Yet they watched it burn with trepidation. There were two small concessions Zuga had made. A single case of Ceylon tea, for, as Robin pointed out, no Englishman could be expected to explore undiscovered territories without that sovereign brew. And the sealed tin, which contained Zuga's dress uniform, for their very lives might depend on impressing a savage African potentate. Otherwise, they had divested themselves of all but the very essentials. Chief of these essentials was the ammunition, the sacks of first-grade Curtis and May black powder, and the ingots of soft lead, the bullet moulds, the flask of quicksilver to harden the balls, and the boxes of copper caps. Out of the remaining 46 porters, 30 of them carried this powder and shot. Jan Schroot's musketeers were horrified when they were informed that their field packs would in future hold 200 and not 50 rounds of Enfield ammunition. "We are warriors, not porters," his corporal told him loftily. Jan Schroot used the metal scabbard of his long bayonet to reason with him, and Robin dressed the superficial wounds in the corporal's scalp. "They now understand the need for carrying extra ammunition, Major," Jan Schroot reported to Zuga cheerfully. It truly was interesting to realize how much fat they could shed, Zuga mused, as he watched the shorter, more manageable column start out. It was less than 150 yards from head to tail, and the pace of its march was almost doubled. The main body nearly matched the speed of Zuga's advance party, falling only a mile or so behind during the first day's march. That first day, they reached the scene of the buffalo hunt before noon, and found more than bark baskets of cured black buffalo meat waiting there. Zuga's gun-bearer, Matthew, came running to meet him through the forest, and he was so excited as to be almost incoherent. "The father of all elephant," he gibbered, shaking like a man in fever. "The grandfather of the father of all elephants." Jan Schroot squatted beside the spur and grinned like a gnome in a successful piece of sorcery, his slant eyes almost disappearing in the web of wrinkles and folds of yellow skin. "Our luck has come at last," he exulted. "This is indeed an elephant to sing about." He took a roll of twine out of the bulging pocket of his tunic and used it to measure the circumference of one of the huge pad marks. It was well over 5 feet, close to 6 feet around. "Double that is how high he stands at the shoulder," Jan Schroot explained. "What an elephant!" Matthew had at last controlled his excitement enough to explain how he had awoken that dawn, when the light was grey and uncertain, and seen the herd passing close to the camp in deathly silence, three great grey ghostly shapes moving out of the forest and entering the blackened and barren valley through which the fire had swept. They were gone so swiftly that it had seemed that they had never existed. But their spoor was impressed so clearly into the soft layer of fire ash that every irregularity in the immense footprints, the whorls and wavy creases of the horny pads, were clearly visible. "There was one of them, bigger and taller than the others. His teeth were long as a throwing spear and so heavy that he held his head low and moved like an old woman, a very old man." Now Zuga also shivered with excitement. Even in the stultifying heat of the burned-out valley, where it seemed the blackened earth had retained the heat of the flames. Jan Schroot, mistaking the small movement, grinned wickedly around the stem of his clay pipe. "My old father used to say that even a brave man is frightened 3 times when he hunts the elephant, once when he sees its spoor, twice when he hears its voice, and the 3rd time when he sees the beast, big and black as an ironstone copy." Zuga did not trouble to deny the accusation. He was following the run of the spoor with his eyes. The 3 huge animals had moved up the centre of the valley, heading directly into the bad ground of the escarpment rim. "We will follow them," he said quietly. "Of course," Jan Schroot nodded. "That's what we came for."